You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration.
Halftime shuffle for Zorro. No pressure to play a halftime shuffle in front of Zorro. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Drummers Education Connection. It's September. It's autumn of 2024. Thanks for joining us. We have the best guest ever, my great friend, my mentor, my dear friend, my teacher, Zorro the drummer. Zorro, thank you for joining us.
Awesome to be with you guys. Thank you for inviting me, Rick. This is going to be fun.
We really appreciate it. And I'm here with all of my best friends. This is deck episode, what, guys? 177, 178th episode, somewhere way up high.
I guess 178.
178. So, welcome from Ontario, California, Bart Ropley. That's Hello. LA. Up in the Bay Area, Jerry Steinkohler. And the man with all the tricks out in Tucson, Arizona, Chip Ritter, the master.
Hello.
Drumstick juggler. Look up chipritter.com. You won't believe it.
Watch out.
Yeah. So we're here every week trying to share with you some insights, some knowledge. We do roundtables on all types of drumming topics. And we interview some of the greatest drummers in the world. And then if you're watching us on Facebook or on YouTube, you can join us and just ask a question. You can ask Zorro questions. So this is a show for you. So we always like to start off with a good, quick thing that's happening in our world. So what about you, Jeremy? What's your good thing? You have something fun happening?
I've had like 2 weeks of amazing things that I haven't. And I was gone last week because I was taking my kid to college. So I dropped my son, Evan, at Northwestern, and that went off great. I cried, but other than that, it was really great. And before that, we had an amazing sold out show. He and I playing together with a trio with a bass player at the Back Room in Berkeley. And it was just like a peak life experience for me playing with him and hearing him shine so brightly and so beautifully. So those are my good things.
I love it. How about you, Bart?
You know, as usual, things are going fantastic. SMB heads out again next week. We go to matter of fact, I want to go to the Zorro clinic at your facility, Rick. I'd be there. But we're playing in Vegas that night, and then we go to Arizona the following week. So I'm not going to be able to make it, but we're doing great there. I'm finishing up a kind of a hard rock heavy metal album that I'm doing right now. So I'm trying to play like Keith Moon and play like an octopus. I got toms everywhere. I'm also working on a new drum sampling thing. I got everything pretty much recorded. I got a couple more cymbals that I want to record, but I'm putting a new drum sample package together that was very inspired by the Joe Franco episode that we did, where he did all the programming. He was talking about doing the programming for Mariah Carey and stuff, and that kind of, man, I want to put a sample package together. So I'm in the middle of working on that, and things are going great. And then a bunch of students, and life is good. Life is great.
Man, it's so good. What's going on with you, Chip?
Hey, you know what? I gotta tell you, my good thing is there's a mystery benefactor, man. One of my students is a guy he's learning drums, and he has a passion for drumming, and he wants everybody to play drums. And I've told him about a couple times about a student that didn't have a drum set, and he bought them a drum set. And just recently, he bought another drum set for some kids that didn't have a drum set or a way to get one. And it just melts my heart. It's awesome to send him a picture of the kids holding up a little thank you sign for their mystery benefactor. Wow. So that's a good thing. It's really cool.
That's amazing. Good for you for facilitating that, man. That's fantastic.
It's very cool.
Zorro, do you have a good thing that you could share with us?
Yeah, I've got a couple of good things. I just got invited by the Los Angeles Chargers football game this coming Sunday. I'm going to be down there at the stadium while they're playing the Kansas City Chiefs. They are purchasing a ton of my copies of my new memoir, Maria's Scarf, and they are giving them out to a bunch of underprivileged kids They do a lot of things for the community. So they're bringing me into the game where I'm going to be signing the books and speaking to all these young kids from sort of underprivileged situations. So it's going to be very fun to be a part of that game. And I have had a great week of concerts last week. A bunch of friends of mine were playing through town. So I got invited to go see Leonard Skinner, got to hang out with my old boss, Bobby Brown. Went to the Jason Aldean show to see my buddy Rich Redman, and then went to a Doobie Brothers concert all within 1 week. So I've been like, just slam it, one fun concert. All good things. And my book, one last good thing. My book, Maria Scarf, my memoir, is a finalist for most inspirational nonfiction book at the International Latino Book Ceremony Awards in LA, which I'll be going to at the end of October. So I'm either going to win gold, silver, or bronze, and there's thousands of books that are entered, so it's a big deal.
That's very good for you. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Man. Really beautiful. Yeah,
beautiful. Always giving back to people, Zorro. It's so impressive. And my good thing is that Zorro is going to be here in San Diego at my studio on Saturday, October 5th, and he's going to be teaching some group drum lessons. Or master classes, whatever you want to call it. We called it group drum lessons because I think people get freaked out when they hear master class. Like, I'm not good enough to study with a master. So I just worded it group lessons, and it's all the same thing. So we're going to do a two-hour workshop at 11 on technique, hand technique and foot technique and timing, and then take an hour break. And then we're going to do one on a whole clinic on essential drumming styles. Fantastic. Which no one knows more about essential drumming styles than Zorro. I'm sorry.
Rick, are you going to videotape those clinics?
Yeah, you know, I've got all the cameras up here, so there's going to be some video being shot for that as well. It's like an overhead of Zorro and a remote angle, and then a camera right at his kit. So I'm very, very excited about that. So if you don't know Zorro, where have you been? Zorro has like, we kind of laugh because it's like a Forrest Gump life that Zorro lives. Zorro, you know, I'm looking on Zorro's social media. There's Zorro at Lenny Kravitz's 60th birthday party hanging out with Selma Hayek. You know, that it's like that. It's, oh, here's Zorro in Africa, like the only white man people have ever seen. And he's there, you know, spreading the word. It's just nonstop. So if you don't know like his music, well, you've got to listen to all of the Lenny Kravitz stuff, Bobby Brown, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, New Edition, Philip Bailey, Earth, Wind and Fire, Vanessa Paradise, Sean Lennon. I'm going to need Brett's here to keep up with all the people that you've played with, Zorro. And then Zorro has been, you know, in Modern Drummer, the number one R&B drummer and clinician year after year. He's known as the Minister of Groove. No one's got a pocket like Zorro, and no one's got stories like Zorro. So, Zorro, how did it all start? Tell us.
I think it starts the way it does with anybody who's a drummer. There's people always ask, you know, like, what made you want to play the drums? And I think for all of us that are on this podcast and that are listening, that are drummers, we didn't choose it. It was in us. All we did was discover something that was always there. I was talking to somebody the other day. I was talking to Alex Van Halen yesterday and talking about how we were talking about tap dancing. And I was saying when I was a kid, I really wanted to tap dance, but I didn't really understand why at the time, but I was just really attracted to it. And then later, as I got older, I realized, oh, well, of course, it's just drumming with your feet. It's just all rhythm. You know what I mean? And tap dancers are the closest thing of all the dance people to like what a drummer does because of the rhythms they play. And Steve Gadd was a tap dancer. So I was
Max Roach too.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of great drummers. Yeah. We're tap dancers. Right. And so for me, it all started with just this strong desire to play. And I had the desire to play drums for a long time before I actually had the chance to actually play. It started when I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old. My mother took me to see Diana Ross and the Supremes and the Temptations in concert when I lived in Compton, California. I grew up in Compton. I grew up in the hood. So I grew up around a lot of R&B music. And that music was just kind of permeated in my blood. And my mother listened to everything from Frank Sinatra. She was from Mexico, to mariachi music, to big band. So I grew up around a lot of music, but I was drawn to that rhythm. And when I went to the Temptation Supreme concert, the next day I was mesmerized by the drummers. And the next day I built a ghetto drum set. And so what that consisted of is I took my red Radio Flyer wagon. I took it down on Compton Boulevard. I took some Folgers coffee cans with me, some empty Folgers coffee cans, empty Almond Roca cans, some Tupperware, salad spoons. And I had a transistor radio listening to the Soul Station, Wolfman Jack. And I just put soul on and just started banging with my hands on my ghetto drum set that I made. And I didn't know I was going to be a drummer. I'd never played, but I guess from the first day I hit anything, I had a gift of rhythm. I had some sense of rhythm in me, untrained, but the desire was there. So I think all of our journeys to the drums are kind of the same. There's this magnetic pull. I look at it like there's this gift that God gave you. It's the gift of rhythm. Mm-hmm. And not everyone has this gift because we don't get to choose gifts. Gifts are given to us. That's why some people can sing. Some people can fly planes. Some people are mathematicians. You know, some people are doctors. The giftings and the natural leanings and talents that we have are not self-given. We're born with them, and we either discover them or we don't. And if we discover them, it's really like discovering a pot of gold. Like you're walking down the street and you see a pot of gold and you say, I like this, I'll take it. So you discover something that's already in you. Some of us are lucky and you discover it very early on in life. Some of us don't discover it till much later. But I promise you, whatever your gifting is, it's always been there. It's always been there. You were born with it. You came into the world with it. But so mine was just not like any other drummer. It's like all you got to do is hear music, hear drummers, hear something rhythmic, and that magnetic pull in you hears that and you're drawn to it. So you immediately respond in your heart like, oh, all you have to do is see somebody do it, hear it, and you're just like, it's a magnet. It's you're pulled right to it and you're sucked into it. You have no choice. This is why I don't play the other instruments. You know, I play drums because I'm drawn to that rhythm. Rhythm's inside of me. So it began with that. And then later, so that was at about 7. And then later we had a life change and moved from the ghetto of Compton, California, which was sort of like the set of Sanford and Son, the old sitcom. and then we moved to rural Oregon, a town with 13,000 people, where it was now like Little House on the Prairie or the Waltons. It was complete polar opposite, different lifestyle. But yeah. It was there that I wanted to enter a talent show. And I wanted to play the drums in the talent show, but I didn't have any drums. So I BS'd my way into the talent show and told the band that needed a drummer. I said, I'm a drummer, I can play. And then I didn't have any drums the first day of rehearsal. All I had was my hands. And so I said, oh, well, my drum set's in the shop. It's getting fixed right now. I can play with my hands on the back of the chair to keep time. And they said, all right. So I did that for a few rehearsals and kept BSing them. I said, well, you better have that drum set by showtime. I said, yeah, no problem. We'll have the drums here. And then, of course, showtime comes. I don't have any drums. So I have to make up another story. And so I said, oh, you know what? My mom went down to pick them up, but they closed. And so I don't have any choice. But so my brothers and sisters, we stayed up all night and we painted on a giant cardboard box. Like it was a big, like, refrigerator or washer and dryer box, you know, those Maytag boxes. We put it on its side. And we painted a drum set on it. It looked like it was a drum set in the front. So at that talent show, I played with my hands on a cardboard box. So you can say I was the inventor of the cajon before it had a name.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I love it.
And that's how I entered the talent show.
But the beautiful thing about that story is that the passion was so great. It even... Yeah. Surpassed the fact that you didn't have an instrument to play. It didn't matter.
You're right, it didn't, because and I realized, like, in different countries and different parts of the world where people don't have resources, you'll see it sometimes on Instagram or YouTube, and you'll see these little kids in Africa, and they've made kind of a drum set out of things that are just on the ground, like brakes, brake pads, and different things. And you just see that creativity is all over the world. So wherever there's desire, like New Zealand, for instance, is a country that didn't always have access to things the rest of the world did because it's so far away. So the people in New Zealand are very entrepreneurial and creative. And you can see that in a movie with Anthony Hopkins called The World's Fastest Indian, which is about a motorcycle and an older guy that wants to race a motorcycle. But they don't have all the parts. They can't get the parts that we get in America. So he has all these makeshift ways of – and you find that wherever – there's will or desire anywhere in the world, even if you don't have the resources, people figure out a way to make a guitar. People figure out a way to play the drums. People, you know, and so I was just a poor kid, you know, grew up with seven brothers and sisters, immigrant mother, no father. We moved 40 times by the time I was in fourth grade. In Oregon, we end up living in a car, which is why I end up playing on the box, because, I mean, you know, there were no resources whatsoever. But what happened was, That box ignited something. And then for Christmas that year, my mother saved up $9.99. It might as well have been $1 million. And she got me a Mickey Mouse drum set. Literally, Mickey Mouse was on the bass drum. It was a Disney, like, but it was a paper heads. It was a toy. And I destroyed it all of Christmas morning. But it was done. But somehow that was like that feeling of just playing for a few seconds would never leave me. And it wasn't until I was 16 years old. Now, I still had not played at all, ever, a real drum set. Now I'm 16, and I have an after-school job as a janitor at my high school. So the school bell rings, and then you see me vacuuming the rooms, cleaning the toilets. Kids would make fun of me, call me all kinds of racial slurs. But that was my 2-hour after school job. But the last part of the job was to clean up the band room, which was the last 20 minutes of the 2 hours. And I could do it in 10. And so for the last 10 minutes, when no one was there, I could sneak on the drum set. And I never played. I never took a lesson, but the stuff was there. And I just wailed away and dreamed about playing drums. One day, the band director was in his office with the door locked, and it was always locked because he was never there. And I didn't know he was there. So he caught me drumming on the job, not drinking on the job, but drumming on the job. And then he said, wait right there, kid. So I know he's going to fire me and get my boss. He brings another guy back and says, play like you were playing. And I just played. And then he looked at the other guy and he goes, kid, he goes, I don't know where you've been hiding. He goes, son, but you've got some real rhythmic talent. You're like a rhythmic genius. I need you in all the school bands. What he didn't know is that I was trying to get in the school band program legitimately from the fourth grade on. But every year I was turned down. They said there's too many drummers. You can't play the drums. So for years I tried and I couldn't get in the program. So now I'm the janitor at the high school, never played the drums, but God gave me a gift. From day one, I could play. I wasn't great, but I could play. I had a sense of rhythm. He saw that and he immediately had me join all the school band program. So all of a sudden in my junior year, because this was the end of my year, in my junior year, I go into my junior year for the first time. I'm playing in the concert band, the stage band, the jazz band, and the swing choir. And he needed me in all of them. I used to skip more school than anyone in the history of the world. Literally in my freshman year, I missed 62 days of school. In my sophomore year, 61 and a half days. When I joined the school bands for my junior year, it went down to 21 days absence, which for me was a 66% improvement because I wanted to be in the school bands. So that's how it all started.
That's amazing. What
a fantastic story.
That's so how good. I got to drum.
I, you know, it's so cool. Everything that you're saying, that's exactly how I think all of us felt growing up. I remember I grew up like the polar opposite. I wasn't in the inner city. I was on a cattle ranch in Colorado, and I wanted to play drums so bad. And we had, you know, 5-gallon buckets, and those were my drums. You know, I remember my dad putting a cymbal stand on there, and he put a piece of plastic that was my cymbal. And if you're drawn to it, the first concert I saw was Elvis, and you know, Elvis kept getting in the way of Ronnie Tutt. I was like, move out of the way. You know, I wanted to watch him play. And I was so, and so everything you're saying, I'm hearing You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I felt it. What, and I want to jump forward, and maybe I'm making a big hole in this conversation, but when I've watched you play, and one of the things you talk about, you're so relaxed, Zorro. When you play, your hands are so relaxed. And I know that's years of practice and all that stuff. But where do you tap into yourself that you're that relaxed when you play? How do you go about doing that?
That's a great question. First, I want to comment on your Elvis thing. So that's super cool. So you saw Elvis live then?
Yep. I was 5 years old. My mom.
Yeah, see, that's amazing.
It was snowing like crazy. And my mom loved Elvis so much and that's all she ever played. And I thought music came from two places. It was either Elvis or the lady that played the out of tune piano in the back of the church. So that's where, music was. And my dad came home with Jim Croce Greatest Hits and a Tom Jones record. And he put on Tom Jones. And I remember thinking to myself, man, Elvis sounds so weird. Maybe he had a cold. And then it equated with me. I was like, oh.
And his chest.
Yeah, right. I was like, maybe, other people can do music. It's not just Elvis. And then, so my mom took me. She knew how much I loved music and how much I loved Elvis. And it was snowing out. So my mom and dad, took me out to Denver Coliseum in 1972.
What year was it?
72. And it was just, when he came out, it was like a bomb went off. It was just like, I don't know what's happening right now, but this is the coolest thing. And of course, I'm watching Elvis, but I was drawn to Ronnie Tutt. And then right after that was Elvis Aloha from Hawaii. And there was a camera right here, right? And it's kind of pointing down. And so Ronnie had this big blue set of Ludwig drums and his hi-hat. It's just going. And I'm going, is that automatic or is he doing that? What's that thing? What's that thing? And I was just, oh my God, I had to do it. I had to do it. And it was just like you're saying, it was like, I don't know why I had to do it. I don't know what it was, but it was there. And just like you, I wasn't the greatest. I was like, okay, I can do this. And I just nurtured it. Yeah.
Well, the Elvis story is great because one of the things along the path to my journey of drumming were pivotal moments that would shape my direction. And one of them was, we were all big Elvis fans in my family. None of us got to see him live. But when the Aloha from Hawaii concert came out, I was glued to the TV and, again, glued to Ronnie Tutt's Blue Sparkle kit. The beautiful thing, and that really inspired me to play the drums. And actually, the only time I hit – there was one time I hit a set of drums for like two minutes, and it was after that special. I belonged to the Big Brother, Big Sister program at the time. My mother signed us as mentors. But my big brother in the program, I had a big brother and big sister. They were actually a husband and wife couple. And so they mentored us three younger kids in my family. But their real son was a drummer in a rock and roll band. And he had a Blue Sparkle Ludwig kit in their living room. Right. So after the Aloha from Hawaii concert, he let me get on there and just like hit him. Now, here's what's beautiful. I stayed friends with the big brother, big sister until they died in their late 70s or early 80s. Wow. So I stayed with them for about 40 years. Before they died, they gave me a little Super 8 reel. And on that Super 8 reel was the little footage of me playing at 12, hitting his drums. So I have footage of me the very first time I ever had sticks in my hands on a real drum set for the 30 seconds I did it. And it was from the Elvis Aloha night of the concert. So anyway, but then at 2 years later, my mother took me to see... We loved Elvis, but we also loved Frank Sinatra. So my mother scrimped and saved and took me to Portland, Oregon, and we went to see Frank Sinatra in concert. And I was glued to Irv Kotler, the big band drumming, just the way he was setting up all those figures. And that became – that's actually a beautiful chapter in my memoir. And my memoir, Maria's Scarf, is my whole story. And every song – every chapter is a song name. So when my mother took me to see Sinatra, the name of that chapter is called Come Fly With Me.
Mm. And, oh, cool.
Yeah, and every, you know, when we lived in the car, it's called Staying Alive, you know, and every chapter is about what's going on in my life at the time, named after a song that sort of depicts it. But the Frank Sinatra thing was a pivotal moment, because when I saw him and Irv Kotler, and that feeling already happened to me with Elvis in 73, now it's 2 years later in 75, I'm seeing Sinatra, and the feeling was, again, like, how do I get on that stage, and what do I do if I'm on there? I just want to be on there. You know, but I was drawn for the drums. And anyway, so I would say that the answer to your question, the relaxation part is, in the years of playing, like Jeff Porcaro was one of my friends in the early days when I first started. And when I was real young, I was practicing so long and hard and so many hours that I had acquired tendonitis in my elbows. And it was bothering me because every time I would play, I could feel this elbow stuff. And so someone had told me that Jeff had struggled with that. So I was just young, like I was like 18 or 19 when I called him, and then he became a friend. And he told me that, you know, that you're probably gripping the sticks too hard and you need to learn to relax more, because he struggled from that too. And he said, well, you need to eat more bananas, because you, when you sweat a lot, you lose potassium. So I drink Gatorade when I'm playing, and I have bananas to keep my potassium. Anyway, that was the beginning of a journey of going, how can I play powerful but with less effort, and how can I have more control? And then I also liked Bruce Lee, and then I realized he could bust your chest from 6 inches away. He didn't need to swing at you with a bat with all his might. So I kind of started noticing people who had very nimble, quick movements but were very powerful in different things, in different sports, in different music. And then I played for a long time with the guitar player from Earth, Wind & Fire. His name's Al McKay, and he was the one on all the records, you know, September, Shining Star. He was the one who wrote half the songs. But he played rhythm guitar with, like, the freaking loosest wrist you ever saw. Like, when he played, it looked like there were no bones in his hand. It looked like a big piece of fleshy rubber just going like this. Like, and I took notice of that. Like, and I see other guys, and they play real stiff, and their whole arm is moving, and they sound stiff. And I go, there's something to do with the way that you play and relax that correlates with the way something feels, you know? And then I started to make that connection. And so then I just, you know, and you'll see it in really great players. You'll see it in, like, you know, these have all been friends of mine for 40, 45 years or so. Like, you'll see it in Steve Gadd. You'll see it in Bernard Purdy. They can hit loud, but they never look like they're straining. And so I just began to, and so then in my young developmental days, I learned that I could play hard, but without working as hard. And I learned to mentally think about relaxing when I played. Like, I would always think, are my arms as loose as they could be? Are my ankles as loose as they could be? Is everything feeling as loose as it can be? So it was definitely a conscious effort to think about it, and then to then apply it. And then I just worked on more and more technical things that made playing easier and looser. So I worked a lot on finger control. I do a lot of things. I've taught thousands of students, and everybody could use more finger control. And then I worked on just more wrist control, like less movements where I practically wouldn't use my arms, were only to get to and from different parts on the kit. Right. You know what I mean? And everything was a, now obviously when you're up here and you're hitting a crash and you're playing, I'm playing with Lenny Kravitz, and, you know, I'm pounding a little harder, but it's still a relaxed power, which is what I realized, like, athletes had, you know, when they're hitting a tennis racket and they're smacking the hell of that thing, or a baseball, there is pressure, but it's a relaxed, relaxed pressure, like hitting a golf. You know, I only golfed a couple times in my life. And when I was first starting, my father-in-law, he was a professional golfer. And then he said something, don't hold it so stiff, like loosen your wrist. And then I thought, oh, it's just like drumming. Yeah. Like, and so as soon as I got that in my head, I was able to launch and hit the ball, the hell out of the ball, by approaching it kind of the way I would with the stick. It's like, let the stick do the work, not me do all the work. Exactly. Let the club do the work. So in every sport and every skill, where hands were used, there's a similarity, and masters have learned to do things in a loose, relaxed, fluid way, but they could still do things with pressure, because you need the pressure to hit a ball far, right? You can't just be so loose that you didn't hit it, you know? So it's a controlled relaxation, I guess. And yeah, every athlete has it. And then when I saw Al McKay, I was only like 18 or 19 when I started, or 20 when I started playing with Philip Bailey, the lead singer of Earth, Wind & Fire. And I started working with Al, and then I just was like, wow. And everyone would say, man, he's the funkiest rhythm guitar player in the world. And then I'd look at him and go, well, that's why. His wrist is so loose.
Yeah.
And so then I started thinking, I need to be that way, like on the drums. Yeah. And that's kind of where it began. You know, you can't do something. You can't play something you haven't heard. You can't emulate something you haven't seen, right? You have to hear something in order to go, like, you can't play a rhythm that you can't hear. I tell this to my students. In other words, you can have like super fast hands, incredible independence and chops, but you cannot play a feel or a groove that you can't conceive.
Right.
And if you can't conceive it because you haven't heard something like that, you'll never come up with something like that. So you have to see it done. You have to hear something and go, oh, that's like when I saw him play the guitar that way. Oh, that's possible. Oh, that's okay. I see. But then you get an image in your head of what you're trying to. And I did the same thing with writing when I wrote my memoir over a period of 15 years. And I love teaching a lot because I love sharing these principles. So I learned that in writing my memoir, and I had written other books. I wrote The Big Gig. That was a 400-page motivational book, and you were telling me about it, Jeremy.
We've all read it. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but we were talking about that before you got on, and it's fantastic book. Thank you for that.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Well, that was a 400-page motivational book that I was looking for myself when I was 18 but could never find.
Right.
All the books I end up writing were books I would have bought if somebody else wrote them.
Somebody else wrote the
R&B drumming book. I was always looking for a book on R&B drumming, not fusion drumming. No offense, but not David Garibaldi, you know, kind of linear funk. That's only one kind of funk. But I grew up with black music, and I never saw any books that really went into that. And so I was always looking for that. And everything they called funk was not really funk, but was really like funky fusion, like Steve Gadd, David Garibaldi funky fusion. But that's not R&B.
Right.
So I end up writing the commandments of R&B drumming to pay honor to all those guys and to document a style that was underwritten about, underrepresented. And then I wrote The Big Gig because I thought one day when I make it, I'm going to write a book to help other people because that was the book I was looking for.
Mm.
And then my memoir was the biggest personal achievement of my life. And the writing was writing a motivational book like The Big Gig or my book Soar is kind of like being a pediatrician. Writing a memoir is like being a neurosurgeon. They're completely different fields of study, and one 10 times harder than the other. For instance, in writing a memoir, you have to learn to be like a fiction writer. You have to learn character arc. You have to learn dialogue. You have to learn scene. You have to learn setting. You have to learn plot lines and through lines and foreshadowing. All this stuff you don't have to do in a motivational book. In a motivational book, I could just write like I'm talking to you. I could just tell you something. In a memoir, you have to create a scene so people feel and see something. So I learned that my writing helped my drumming and my drumming helped my writing. Because as I learned to be a better writer, I realized, this is very similar to drumming. In the beginning, you learn all this crap. You overplay, you learn all these things so that you can then now underlearn what you learned. And now you call it out. And so you learn all these words, but you're not going to use them all because a real writer, a great writer, is not going to use a word that's big just to impress you unless it was the perfect word. Just like Steve Gadd is not going to play every lick he could play. I was with him the other night, he was playing with James Taylor. He's going to play only what works for that song. And you might not know that his vocabulary is much larger than that.
Exactly.
So the job of a drummer, the job of a writer, the job of every creative artist in the world, whether you're a painter, a screenwriter, a musician, I've whittled it down to one thing. You only have one job, and that job is to elicit emotion, to make people feel something deeply. And when you make them feel something deeply in your groove or in your fill or in the passage that I wrote, I had to learn to write sentences that were long And then I had to learn to write medium length sentences. And then I had to learn to write sentences that were short. Jesus wept, two words. You have to mix them up. Your ear gets bored with the same length of phrases when you're reading. Right. The reader doesn't know that, but a good book makes you keep wanting to read because there's varying lengths of things. Well, isn't that just like fills and phrases on the drums? So everything is phrasing, but in the end of the day, I approach drumming the same way I approach writing. I'm a very passionate guy, and I don't know, I'll never know, because I only lived the life that I did, but I lived a life of desperation for all of my formative years up until about 18. I lived in desperate crisis situation in my family, desperate to survive, desperate to be approved, desperate for my father's approval, which I never got, just desperate. And so I think what happened was that desperation in your formative years makes you a very creative and passionate artist, because when I play the drums or when I write, I'm doing it as if my life depended on it. I'm pouring every bit of my heart and soul into every note, whether it's triple pianissimo or triple forte. I'm pouring my emotion into my writing, every sentence. At the end of the book, my memoirs, you know, 400 pages, it's longer than the big gig. And at the end of it, I went and did a complete thorough word search. This is after I went through the developmental editor stage, the final stage with the publisher. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I went through a word search to look for every time I used a certain word and find out how many times did I use that phrase, like dream or fantastic or amazing. And how many places can the sentence live without it? And how many places not live without it? And how many times can I switch it to a different word and make it more interesting so the reader doesn't get bored? For instance, there's a word I use in the book. It's just like it's like a gong. There's a word I use in the book. It's when I met Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, and it was a random meeting, and I opened the door, and all of a sudden, it's Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. I'm 18 years old, and it's like a life-changing moment. And I use the word in the book. I said, I opened the door, and I was gobsmacked to find myself shaking Michael Jackson's hand at the Jackson 5. Now, gobsmacked is a word you can't use a bunch, or you've overused it. It's too big of a word. It's like my 48-inch Sabian gong I used with Lenny Kravitz. I only used it once in the damn show. Once.
You only need to use it once.
At the end of American Woman, it fit because we were doing this sort of little passageway that felt very Indian and tribal, and it was this long groove, and at the end, the gong made sense. I have this big, giant gong set up, but I only used it once, because if I used it more, it would have been like using gobsmack twice. Exactly. And when you use gobsmack twice, he just used that word already. You can use common words more frequently, but not uncommon words. So I did a whole word search to make sure I used every best adjective I could, and then removed every adjective that was not necessary. Yeah. And the reader will never know that, except that I have found that everyone who's read it has told me that they could not put it down, that it was riveting, that it took them through an emotional roller coaster where they laughed, they cried, they got angry. Well, that's what you want people to feel as a musician. When you play, I want people to feel all of those things. I want them to feel the dynamics of a pianissimo, just a soft whisper. I want to play as quiet as Ed Thigpen played. When he played like a roaring lion who was whispering. You know, it's like you're going, how can he play so intense, but yet it be the volume that's 90% lower than anybody else could play, but yet it never felt wimpy, you know? And that's what I learned. That's control. That's finesse. That's touch. That's relaxation. Right. And then how could I play as loud as Alex Van Halen, you know, when I need to be that loud too. And all of it draws on different emotions in people. It's like a Black Baptist preacher speaking. If he's yelling at you the whole time, you stop listening. But if he goes, man, the Lord, and then he said, you know what I mean? They draw you in and they yell.
Right.
It's just when you're going like, oh my God, he sucks you, and then he hits you over the head with a mallet, you know, and that keeps you interested. That keeps you listening. Right. Like when you watch a movie and it gets real quiet, and then all of a sudden that dude comes out of the closet with the hammer and you freak out because it came out of a real quiet moment. But that's what I try to do with dynamics when I'm playing. I try to have those really super duper pianissimo things. And then when I go all barrel in, man, then they feel something dramatic. And I learned that writing and painting and all those things and movie making are about the same thing. making people feel something deeply. So it doesn't matter if you're a writer with this huge vocabulary, if you're not right and you're really schooled, if you're not writing with heart and passion and making people feel something deeply because you care more about them than you. But the problem with drummers and writers and creative people is if you're not mature, you care more about you than the audience. So then you go, I just want to flex and show my writing chops. So I'm going to use all these words that are not necessary because it's not the best word. It's not the most useful word, but it shows that, hey, I'm really studied in literary. But then you lose certain readers, right? And so people can sense that, you know, and they sense when, you know, yes, he learned all these words, but he only used these two. It's just like Gad knows all these patterns, but he only played the most simplest spells with the, right. When I was with him the other night, we talked for 2 hours and he said something to me. He goes, he's in almost 80. He said, every night before I play, he goes, I pray to the Holy Spirit and I ask God to help me get out of the way so that he can play with me and so that I have no ego and all of my ego is completely removed so I can serve the music. And when I heard him, I said, dude, you have succeeded in doing that. I said, you are more musical now than I've ever heard you, and you've been one of the most musical guys I've known for 45 years. I said, but you played so where when you get older, maybe you don't have the power you had when you're 21. Where you make up for that is you have this incredible control and finesse that you could never have at 21. It's just this tenderness where you're going, oh my God, the groove is so fat and so huge. But he's so relaxed. And yet he did a little short solo and could still hit the hell out of the drums. You know what I mean? So, and you just see over time, you see how people mature. And the mature people are always thinking about the audience. How could I get out of the way? How could I serve the song? How could I serve James? Not like, how can I show them that I'm Gad and they can hear all my licks, right. You know? And so there's just always so much to learn. But that's sort of my long answer for how I developed. I teach all my students about touch. I'm like, a million guys can hit the same beat and play the same drum set. And guys used to write into Modern Drummer and they would write into people like Tony Williams and say, what cymbal are you using? Because I, on that Miles Davis record, so I want to buy that exact cymbal and sound like that. And Tony would say, it's not the cymbal, man. The cymbal. Your hands, it's the player. And he carries that sound with him wherever he goes. Yes, a good drum set will make you better. Yes, a good cymbal helps you more. But all the great players I know, their sound is in their hands and drummers in their feet, in their approach. And I said, you can have 100 drummers playing the same beat from the same exact record, transcribing the same thing, and everyone will sound different because everyone holds the sticks different. Everyone touches the drums different. And I call it your inner dynamic mix. The guys that I've always been attracted to have a natural, beautiful mix between kick, hat, and snare. Unless you're jazz, it's ride, you know, kick and snare and hat with your foot, right? But it's the volumes that they naturally play between those three that make up the sound and the way they touch and hit the sound. And Ed Shaughnessy taught me that the only thing Buddy Rich ever taught him, he shared with me all these Buddy Rich stories. He goes, Buddy and I would always get together, but Buddy never liked to talk shop. And finally, Ed goes, Ed, you know, Buddy, I've known you for years and you've never taught me anything. Teach me something. Show me something. And Ed showed it to me. It was like, it was about how when Buddy plays in his mind, he goes, I am trying to pull sound out of the drums. I'm not trying to push sound through the drums. Mm-hmm. So it's about, and then that stuck with me. It's like, so when I hit, I'm always trying to think I'm pulling tones and sounds out. I'm not trying to crush sound through it. I'm trying to bring sound out of it. And it's an approach. But all of that makes different guys sound different. And I'll hear some guys and they play so loud with the snare and so forceful, especially in sort of the urban gospel hip hop thing. Everything is so on 10, 11 the whole time. It's like the drums are just, they're crushing the sound out of them, and they're not getting a full sound because the tone is dead because they're burying the left stick into the head after each hit, and there's no tone to breathe. Right. So it's just like, you know, and all they got chops up the yin yang, but then I close my eyes and go, but this sound doesn't relax my soul. Like, I want to close my eyes and hear somebody who makes my soul relax, even if they're loud or quiet. Does my soul feel relaxed, or do I feel some kind of angst? You know, from their approach. Approach is everything.
you know, to come back to some of the things, God, you've talked about so much in the last 20 minutes, and like I've wanted to jump in like 100.
I know,
times.
Me too.
I'm sorry.
No. It's fantastic. It's beautiful, and it's everything we want out of someone with your wisdom and experience, you know, to share with our community. So thank you for sharing all this fantastic information and inspiration and great stuff. And so much of it, I know Bart and Rick and Chip are all feeling the same way. We're like, I had that experience too. That's just what I say to my students. I tell them that all the time. And it's just like golf, and it's just like that. And
I thought of you when he said golf, Jerry.
Well, it's the same thing, man. Relaxed hands and drawing the sound of the drum. Peter Erskine talks about pulling the sound out of the ride cymbal in the same way when you're keeping jazz time, and Daniel Glass and John Riley, all those guys, everyone's hip to it because it's the way to do it. And this is all about intention, and it's all about what you are trying to get out of the instrument to contribute to the music, to elicit from the listeners.
Yeah.
And it's the connection you have with the people you play with, and it's the connection you have as a group with the audience that's listening to you. And all the things that Zara was talking about come down to, you know, paying attention and caring and having this intention of not just sort of like, oh, here's my beat and it goes with whatever it goes with, or here's how I play it. No, what you're playing is in the moment, and it has to be, you have to be attentive to the moment, and all the stuff that you've practiced and all the things that you've learned come to bear on that moment every time you play. And man, you do it as good as anyone who's ever done it. And thank you for sharing all this inspiration with us.
Well, I love teaching. I love sharing. Go ahead.
Oh, I have a question in regards to your writing, because everybody here on deck, we're all authors. We've all written books. Some of them are instructional books. Jeremy has an amazing literary book out. I wrote my first one this year. I'm really influenced by people who are creative as musicians, writers, cooking. You know, I'm interested in all those things. One of my favorite drummers who's a writer too is polar opposite for me, but it's Bobby Rock. He's a great drummer, great writer. Yeah, amazing guy. And he writes all the time. And he talks about going on writing retreats and how he writes and stuff. I'm curious, have you taken writing classes? Do you go on writing retreats? How do you pull the words out of you? How do you dig down that deep and pull them out?
Great question. Well, so my when I lived in Oregon, and this, when you look at your life and you look back on it, this is how I see it. It's like God wired me with certain unique attributes, and if I go look into the early part of my life, it becomes evident they were always there, and maybe I didn't really discover the real depth of them until. So writing for me goes all the way back to when I was a kid moving from Compton to Grants Pass. So I'm going from this urban jungle where I never saw rivers, trees, or lakes or anything like that. It was concrete power lines and aqueducts and all that. So I get to Oregon, and it's beautiful in Grants Pass. It's a mountain town, 13,000 people surrounded by mountains and lakes and trees. So obviously as a 10-year-old, 11, 12-year-old kid, like my dream at that point was to go camping. Like I was like, man, I want to go camping. You know, this looks amazing, but I couldn't afford to go camping because we didn't have any money to send me camping. We didn't have camping stuff or whatever. So what do you do if you're me and you can't go camping, like the drum set thing? I checked out every book in the library, the county library, about camping, and I decided I was going to write the world's greatest camping book. I was going to write
about ever having been camping. I love it.
Camping, but I didn't put my words mine. I can write it better because I read every camping book, and I found certain things I liked in one, but then not in the other. And I go, well, but this one's got this, but this guy missed that. And so I had like 10 camping books and read every one. And I go, oh, I'm going to like a composite of all this and have the best camping. And so I would literally have my pencil and paper at the doctor's office, the dentist's office, my mother's grocery shopping. And I had my little pen doing my camping book till I had a big thing in my little Mexican briefcase called a mochila. And I was going to submit it to like publishers. I mean, I was 12 years old, but the camping book never came out. But when I look back, I go, oh man, that was the writer already in me without me realizing a writer. Yeah. And then when it came to my, the drum books were the first thing I wrote, you know, and I wasn't a great writer then, in terms of I just knew what I wanted to write about and about the history and all that. And then the first really big deep book was The Big Gig, which is a very fine book. But when I look that compared to my it's 2024 and my memoir came out. The Big Gig came out in 2012. It won all kinds of awards. It is a good book. It's a motivational book. But I never had intended to write my memoir because I never thought I had the chop. I wasn't stupid. I knew that you're not all of a sudden a great memoir fiction writer just because I can write a motivation book. Motivational books are easy because it's called tell, don't show. All I have to do is tell you things.
Right.
In a memoir, it's show, don't tell. So I could say, oh, I had this incredibly strong Mexican mother with this incredible faith. Well, that's just telling you. That's not moving you. Instead, I have to create a whole chapter in a scene where you see this for yourself and you go, what a strong woman of faith she was, because I told you a story. That's much harder. You got to create a scene. And die. So what I did is originally I hired a guy and I was just going to tell him my story and he was going to write it. And that was 15 years ago. And we had a lot of publishers that wanted to publish my memoir. But then every time it got to the round table of the sales and marketing team, that's where it would get turned down. Because those guys just want big numbers. How many followers does he have? Does he have 2 million followers? The people, the editors always love the story. So I never got the book deal. So then I realized the only way this book's ever going to happen is if I write it. So then I began this journey. I read over 300 books that I have in my library, highlighted all over the damn place. I read over 300 books in 15 years on the art of writing memoir, on the art of writing fiction, on the art of editing, everything to do with writing. I went to school for it in my own way. I then collaborated with great editors who were like great master drummers. Like when I've taken lessons from the world's greatest drummers, you know, backstage, I did the same thing with some of the world's greatest writers/editors. So they would take, and my story, I started writing out my story. Literally, I can show you the evolution of, I'm talking about my memoir story. In all of my books, there's little pieces of my story, but they're not written like a memoir. The memoir is like really a beautiful read, an evocative read, an emotional read. That's going to be a movie and a Netflix series sometime in the near future. Wow. But at any rate, so I started off with little simple vignettes. It would be like, tell the story of playing on the box in fourth grade talent show. That would evolve into like 2 or 3 sentences. Then it would evolve into a paragraph, a badly written paragraph. Then it would evolve into like a badly written page or two. And it all started with these little tiny vignettes that then morphed into more and to more and more. And then eventually through the studying of the craft, you know, I watched those master classes. I went to writing workshops or writing conferences. I met with other writers and I just loved the craft, you know, and I loved learning. So I immersed myself in that world like I did in the drumming world with the same level of intensity. I'm just an intense guy. Rick will tell you, whatever I get into, I don't know how to do anything like on 2 or 3. I'm immediately at 11. You know what I mean? If I get it,
in case you're wondering, we can tell. I don't need to ask Rick. Okay.
It comes as a shock, but
it drives my wife crazy. I don't know. Like when I got into CDs, you know, when records first came on CD, if I'd get into somebody, let's say whoever, James Brown, all of a sudden somebody hips me to somebody, some fusion group, all of a sudden I got to have every James Brown record he ever made. I can't just have the 3 great ones or best hits. I got to know them all so I can really understand them. I'm that way with everything.
So and, you would dig so deep. I remember back in the day, I'd come over to your house. You had maybe 10,000 CDs. This is before everything was streaming.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the number? 15,000 CDs. So you
dug deep. You guys, I know we're getting short on time, but before we close out, we have 5 minutes or so. I've got to just make a plug for The Big Gig. I know you were saying, oh, that was written 12 years ago. It wasn't the best writer, as good a writer as you are now. And I'm sure that's true, of course, with all the time you spent, but it's a really well-written book. And if you're interested, it's not just for drummers and it's not just for musicians. Like if you're interested in like taking your game of whatever kind to the next level, this is a really, really, really good book that tells you all about the industry and how, what's important to tap into, how to surround yourself with people that'll help you grow. And it's, you know, it's amazing. It's fantastic. And I highly recommend it. Just get the book, The Big
Here, Deal. Here. Every student that's ever come in here who said, I want to make a career as a musician, like, you have to get The Big Gig, because you've got to be realistic. You've got to be honest with yourself, and you've got to give yourself the best fighting chance to become a successful musician. And how to do that is all in here. I love the end. It's 50 questions to determine your chances of scoring The Big Gig. And there's 50 questions. And if you start going through that, and if you answer them honestly, it'll tell you a lot about about what's really involved in doing this. And so it's a good look in the mirror. And I know that this has helped a lot of my students grow, and some of the ones who become successful, a lot of it's because of this book.
It's so, a blueprint.
I put a lot of work into that. So it's really,
every
project I've done, by the time I get to the end of my life, there'll be a handful of things that I did. I'm not a guy who could churn out, like, there are guys that churn out like hundreds of drum books or hundreds of novels or hundreds of whatever. I've never been that guy. Everything I do, I have to, it's not ego. It's not pride. It's this belief that I have that God gives you unlimited potential in a certain arena. You don't get to choose the arena, because people would all say, oh, I want to be an athlete, or I'm going to be this, or I'm going to be a doctor, or whatever. It chooses you. It's given to you, right? So I look at it like this. God, before I was born, in me was deposited the ability to write, to speak, to teach, and to play music. Those four things were given to me. They're given to me in the form of a seed, means they have the seed of potential. If I plant that seed in the ground, it's an acorn. If I take care of it, if I work it, if I nurture it, if I water it, if I protect it from the doubt, from the naysayers and all that, then, and the birds of the air, then I can turn that into a mighty oak tree. And, but at no time did I give myself the magic bean, the magic seed. So I look at life as an opportunity to thank God. So God's gift to us is our potential, right? Our gift back to God and the world is, what did we do with that potential? How much of it did we develop? And ultimately, did anybody else benefit from it besides us? Right. Did it help other people? Was your journey a journey of self, or was your journey a journey of service? If you remain humble and teachable and thankful that you got the gift from somewhere, you can't. It's like being Bill Gates' son and then bragging that you're a millionaire. Well, yeah, your dad's a billionaire. So, like, you know, humble. You got it from him. So, right. But yes, you turned it into more. So that's how I look at it. I go, you know, my job is to be humble, which means I'm teachable and I can learn. And then I understand what my purpose is. My purpose is to make a difference. So if I have, you know, the Commandments of R&B Drumming series, The Big Gig, Soar, my memoir, and eventually a movie and a series, that's not a lot of projects besides all the gigs and the playing and the teaching. But those are projects that I put my all into that will continue to make a difference even when I'm not here. And right. That's the reason I work so hard on my memoir, because my memoir is the story of a boy with a dream against all odds, the unbreakable bond between a mother and a son, and the family struggle to survive, and how the kid was able to live out the dream against all odds. Now, that's a story for everybody. That's not a story just for drummers. That's a story that can inspire absolutely any human being. And there's only so many people in my lifetime that I'm going to meet one-on-one, only so many master classes I can do, only so many people I'm going to meet at airports. But a book or a movie or a streaming whatever, that could touch people all over the world that I'll never meet in my lifetime. And even when I'm dead, from the grave, I'll be impacting and affecting people, because we read things that are 200 years old and 2,000 years old. So yeah. That's that kind of the big picture for me, is I'm very intentional, because I know I got a limited amount of lifespan. You know, for a limited amount of time, God offers you life, and then one day it expires. So what I'm trying to do is squeeze as much out of it as possible, help as many people as possible with the experiences I have, the knowledge that I have, the personality that I have, the character that I have, and go, how can I make a difference? And all of these projects take a long time. But in the end, I'm super proud of each one. Yes, I'm a better drummer now than I was playing with all the people I played with, because I continue to practice and continually honing the craft. But I'm happy with what I did in my 80s with New Edition or Bobby Brown or Lenny Kravitz or Earth, Wind & Fire, whatever. But I'm still growing, just like I saw Gad grow. you know, and I'm going, mm-hmm. this is the idea. Grow until you go, help as many people as you can, and be intentional, because you only have a certain amount of time to make this difference. But I want to be able to go, hey, at the end of my life, when I see God, there's a story, there's a parable in the Bible about the talents, and the master gives different talents to different people. And then one day he comes back and asks you, what'd you do with my investment? A talent was money in the old days. And the master comes back and says, what'd you do with the 5 talents I gave you? What'd you do with the 10? What'd you do with the 100 I gave you? And the guy who did nothing, who only had 5 talents, he's considered a wicked servant. But the guy who was given 100, who turned it into 1,000, he's a faithful servant, because he took what he had and he multiplied it. And that's what we do. We take this little drumming gift we have and we multiply it. And we start off with, oh, I can only do this and that. And in the end, you've turned it into this. Your whole life should be this. See yourself as a fruit tree. So let's say I'm an apple tree. That's what I can. I can't be anything but an apple tree. You can't be anything but what you are, right? So I'm an apple tree. My job is to grow delicious apples so people can come from miles around. And when they bite off of Zorro's apple, they go, this is a yummy, tasty apple. This satiated me. This was sweet. This was good. And not be some person where you bite on their apple and it's filled with worms and it's mealy, because those are people that are selfish, self-centered, arrogant, mean, ungrateful, never helping anybody. They got talent. They got fame. They got money. But they're jackasses that don't understand their purpose, and that one day the plug's going to be pulled. So for me, I'm going, hey, I want to make sure that I was growing delicious apples and that a lot of people got fed while I was alive. And that's my story.
Thank you for all the apples, because I eat those apples every day, and I'm a testimonial to your success in this. I've taught thousands of students every day. I'm like, hey, let me show you this or that, and it's something that Zorro taught me. And then those people have gone on to gig and teach, and you're just passing all of these great messages on and all of this inspiration. My entire book series, you know, the How to Build a Drum Groove, that was based on conversations and lessons that we had. And I appreciate that you wrote the foreword for that, and just all of the knowledge that you share. And we are just so excited to have you on our show. And you can come back anytime. Chip, did you have something?
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question. Number one, thank you again for doing the show, Zorro. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
My
question is, how did you get the name Zorro?
That's in my memoir, Maria Scarf, which is, just by the way, for anybody who's interested, it's on Amazon. I also narrated the audiobook. It's on Audible. It's available everywhere around the world where books are sold, called Maria's Scarf. I promise you, you will not be able to put it down, and you will be moved deeply. But the name originally came because when I grew up in Compton, I was around 6 or 7 years old. And you know, when you grow up in the hood, you do some less than notable things at 6 or 7. And one of them is, I was hanging out with a bunch of thugs that were older than me, and they would kind of use me to go into like a Rexall drugstore and like steal some stuff. You know, like candy and kites and, you know, a G.I. Joe or whatever. So I was a little kleptomaniac, and I couldn't visit the same places too frequently. So for one year I put on a Zorro mask for Halloween. And then I decided I was going to put the Zorro mask on the next little drug heist I do at 6 or 7. And I figured, well, they won't recognize me if I have the Zorro mask. And that was my thinking. Even though I had a cowlick like alfalfa, I was skinny, you'd recognize me in a heartbeat with that mask. But in my mind, I'm like, the mask is covering me up. So I went in to steal a bunch of newspapers. When back in the day, when you put a quarter and open the machine, and you could grab 5 if you wanted, it was the honor system. But I didn't have any honor, so I wore my Zorro mask into the liquor store. And then my mother started nicknaming me Zorro. She goes, you know. And then when I got older and started drumming, she goes, you should call yourself Zorro like when you were a kid, because you always had a heart for the poor and for the underdog, because Zorro was always robbing from the rich to give to the poor. That was his whole thing, right? He was like a Mexican Robin Hood. So it came from the nickname of me wearing the Zorro mask at 6 or 7. And then when I actually started drumming, I started wearing a bolero hat that I got from the bullfights in Mexico City. And then when I got the gig with New Edition, they actually on their own just started calling me Zorro. They were like, yeah, yo, Zorro, check it out. We want you to do this on the hi-hat, because they saw the hat and I had a very Spanish gaucho kind of get up. And then that's when I realized that's it. My mother said, you should just call yourself Zorro. And then I've never looked back. And so that's how it all started.
Wow, that's one cool.
50 cent, you know, plastic mask from the 70s or the 60s.
Yeah.
And a nickname was born. And I never looked back.
Legend is born.
I will tell you this. If you want to know my real name, the memoir is really, it starts off with who I am as a kid. And then you see towards the end of the book how I become Zorro. In other words, it's the evolution of my real name as a kid. I'm that kid through the whole story. And then the end is you see the kid become Zorro and you see him live out his dream against all odds. And wow. By that point, you're cheering for him and the family because you've seen all the crap he's had to overcome. And it's just like an underdog movie. My story is like a Blind Side, a Rocky, a Rudy meets Forrest Gump, but Zorro style. It's original. It's not any of those stories, but it has the feel of that David and Goliath story to it. You know.
That's so cool, man.
But anyway, and that's why I'm this passionate guy, man. It goes back to my childhood, you know, and nothing's changed.
Congratulations on publishing that. And we're all going to check it out, of course. And we recommend you do too, and check out The Big Gig and check out any of the stuff, and you know, those bands that Zorro's played with. It's really some fantastic drumming that will inspire you. Zorro, thank you so much for coming on our show. We'd love to have you back again in the future. And
We'll do it. I look forward to it. There's much more to talk about. I didn't let you guys talk enough. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. Everybody's heard us.
These are the best kind of interviews. You know, it's kind of like wind him up, let him go. Thanks for watching an hour late. Zorro, thank you so much.
I'll come back for sure, and we'll talk more specific about different drumming skills.
If you end up doing another master class at Rick's place, I mean, I will definitely be there. I think it was before you got on. I'm playing, it's on the 5th, and I'm playing in Vegas that night. So,
yeah, so we missed each other.
Yeah,
I'll be back.
I'm very fortunate that I get to travel a lot and play music. And I was saying before we went on the air that happens a lot. Like, there'll be a clinic in town and I want to go see it so bad, but I'm playing. So I'm very excited. I'm very thankful for that. But if you do it again, I'll definitely be there for sure.
Well, thank you. And thank you all for hosting me and wanting me as a guest. And Rick and I go back 20 some years, and it's just been one of the best people on the planet, period. He's just got full of light, love, and joy. And it's been sowing into him and seeing the fruit that he's born in his own life from the things that I've deposited in him. Because that's the thing, is we're just here to pass it to the next people. And Rick is carrying the baton. And when I'm no longer on this planet, he'll have all kind of Z stories to share with people. and like we do with all the people we've lost, you know.
We call Rick there. Well, I gave him the nickname, the positive energy hand grenade, because you can't him and the saxophone player in my band. I always say, if you put those two guys in a room together, they'd be like, you're the greatest. No, man, you're the greatest. No, man, you're the greatest. No, man, you're the greatest. That's what it would be like. You know,
he is really a special guy, and you guys are all awesome. And thank you for all the things you guys do in the world to make a difference through drumming and teaching and mentoring and writing. And it's cool that we're all drummers and writers, right? We're just people.
You're right.
That's awesome. What we have to share, you know? We evolve in our expressions of creativity, you know?
Exactly.
And this has been a joy. I'm glad this is the only time I've done a podcast outside of a doctor's office, but hey, this is the first time.
All right, man.
Thank you, Zorro. Appreciate it, Zorro.
Thanks, Zorro. All right.
See you October 5th, Zorro.
October 5th. I'll be there.